administrative staff back there, which consisted of about two very good yeomen and a couple of other good people. The officer being a very young and a fine individual, Ted Smedberg, who was the son of Vice Admiral Smedberg, retired at that time. They were standing by when the plane arrived at Andrews about midnight. The Admiral departed to his quarters, as he should, and I imagine he had a bundle of messages he had to get through that night anyhow. While I went to the Pentagon with the staff, and we spent all night preparing the material in the smooth, getting the few graphs made. We had ordered a dot nav graphic shop to stand by because we were going to need continual production of few graphs with artwork necessary during the night to be ready so that 7 a.m. in the morning he could be ready to go over the proposed briefing. We had appointments set up with SecNav for like and the VCNO for 8 o'clock. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at 8:30, this is just representative, it may have varied from that, a meeting in the tank with the Joint Chiefs to go work with them. And then his aide would be trying to get the schedule set up with the White House. That was the kind of frantic schedule it was, and it's kind of representative because this one, the stuff hit the fan in Chile when our presence in Chile was in very transition because the new president,
Allende.
Yeah, President Allende, was a communist, and but said that he was very open to accepting support from the United States. He wasn't closing that out. Chile had a long record of democracy. It was one of the best in South America. And the military had been very loyal to civilian leadership, but they were in a considerable state of agitation with the way that election had gone with the Labor Party or Socialist or Communist, I forget what the front was. And we knew that the Chinese were interested in getting a wedge in there of for commerce because of some related industries and fishing and so forth. And we were, first of all, Admiral Zumwalt made that trip as the representative of the president. Admiral Moore, as chairman, was not able to go because of another high-level commitment, and so they had selected Admiral Zumwalt to go. When we got to Chile, well, first of all, the ambassador had been there about 30 days, had not yet even made a call on Allende to present his paper and be certified, as is the normal protocol, whatever that might be. He, his orders were that he would be cool but socially correct. That means you'd shake hands, but you wouldn't squeeze it, I guess. Also, the ambassador, who was a man of his own unique personality, chose not to even meet the admiral when he arrived at the airport, which was rather unusual for, you know, a four-star not to be met by the local ambassador, who was of some lesser rank. And so he was treating Admiral Zumwalt maybe unsocially and coolly.
He was a pain.
At any rate, we knew that we were not supposed to get involved with Allende, and that was not the intent of the admiral. He was visiting primarily with the military personnel being hosted then the tour, as it turned out, by the Chief of Naval Operations of the Chilean Navy.
Whom he knew.
And as we were riding from the capital of Chile,
Santiago, to
Valparaiso, from Santiago to Valparaiso. CNO of the Chilean Navy, and I can't remember his name either. We were about 25 miles out of Valparaiso, and he turned around to the admiral alongside him and said, with a big smile on his face, I have been informed that we have a special treat in store for you on this trip, and on this visit to Valparaiso, which is their Naval Academy. And looked at me and I looked at him, kind of surprised us, we didn't need down there. He said a very important person has invited you to come visit with him. And the Admiral said yes, and, you know, raised his eyebrows of who, and he said Private President Allende would like to speak to you. And, Admiral Sumwalt, you know, as we later discussed, what can you say? You're in the man's car, his driver's driving. You can't say this would probably not be a good idea for my future and for the wishes of the President or Kissinger or the Ambassador, because you would immediately cast reflections on them that would do irreparable damage. So all you can do is graciously accept the invitation, knowing that he would not be making any commitments, but it would give him an opportunity to assess this individual firsthand. And so we made a sign to the Presidential Palace. There was really no opportunity to communicate back even to the embassy of what we were doing, because they had chosen not to send a representative with us. We went in, the meeting was in what was called their public room. It was a large room, a good 20 by 40 feet, ornately decorated, but with glass all around on three sides of it. And you come in through this other very ornate hall into the public room. And this was held over from, or was a reflection of, the democratic type meetings of which previous presidents had held, and Allende was trying to show that he was open to the public. And literally, the public could come up these stairs and walk these corridors and see who the president was meeting with at the time. They couldn't hear, but they could see, you know, government in process. It's like the Oval Office had a walk-around view that the public was able to get into. Of course, there were well-armed gendarmes all along the area. But it was interesting from that standpoint. Allende had an interpreter, and there was one other individual, a very fine person from the State Department, not State Department, but from our ISA of SecDef, a former congressman by the name of Armitage.
Yeah, Armitage.
And that's mentioned in the book anyhow. Mm-hmm. But my role was that little fly speck sitting back. Allende had his interpreter sitting there, and I was sitting on the other side of the Admiral with my, as President Allende used to say, the man with the little black book, just taking notes like mad. Allende, although he used his interpreter, spoke perfect English, understood English very well, but he used the interpreter to give him a chance to compose his answers while the interpreter was prattling on, you know, interpreting. A very interesting technique. But he proudly showed us a table model that he had in that room of what they were going to do to the port, to more than one port along the coast, of improvements. And he said this would be excellent for the people of American industry to come down and invest in, and other, you know, things, looking like he was the great friend of USA and courting it. And he said, yes, the Chinese are interested in it, but I'm also considering all options. Words to that effect. Spent over an hour with him, and one of the things that he also did was extend a very warm and cordial invitation for one of our new nuclear carriers.
The Nimitz.
Was it the Chester Nimitz? Mm-hmm. To stop in. It was in transit around South America.
In Brazil at the time.
And was on the east coast of South America and was coming around and heading up to San Diego. And he knew of that, mm-hmm. and extended an invitation for him to stop for a port visit. He said, now I know you might be concerned about some demonstrations by members of my political party that might make it embarrassing, but I can assure you there will be no embarrassment and no demonstrations. And you got the feeling that he could enforce what he was saying. Well, it was my job then to write up the report that had to go out each night on each of these steps, with the admirals approving the message then and getting them off and through the embassy code rooms. And that was a very delicate rope to walk, and assuring that no commitment had been made by Admiral Sumwalt. And it turned out that Henry Kissinger had been the author of this cool but proper policy, and he was adamantly opposed to any visit by the carrier. And for various reasons, some of which appeared reasonable, such as setting a bad precedent now that we have a democratic leader in a country of South America, will this only encourage other, as is all too often the case, a revolt, something less than a democratic replacement of a government. But at any rate, that was an issue that Henry Kissinger took great exception to, the fact we even made the visit, ignoring the fact that it would have even given him bigger headaches had the admiral been rude and resisted. It would have sent no good signal, and it would have done damage. But anyhow, that was kind of the feeling of what those trips could get into. That was mm-hmm. the most spectacular, probably.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about something that happened a little bit later. How, and we can spend some time on this perhaps, how you came to be chosen to head the recruiting effort, and your perception of the manpower problem, the retention problem, and maybe because this is later in his term as CNO, the Z-grams have had time to have some effect, or to, and from your view as head of recruiting, what problems is the Navy facing? How has the Navy adjusted to what Admiral Sumwalt has tried to do, and what was the hope or the view you had of what the future might hold immediately while you were trying to recruit quality personnel after the draft had ended? And if you would, you could start with the call after, when you were down commanding the flotilla. That must have been a...
Yeah, we had just gotten back from the Mediterranean, and we had been involved in a very interesting exercise that we set up, and I had a brilliant young officer by the name of Cliff Willis on the staff that had set this up, trying to see if we could trick the Soviet long-range aircraft into coming out to try and locate us. We set up a decoy and a shadow and then a deceptive run using devices, and sure enough, we did euchre the Soviets into trying to find us with their long-range aircraft, and we wanted to find out from which bases that search would originate. Very interesting results, and so I felt it proper to go to Washington as soon as we got back and brief them on that exercise and what we had learned and whatever pattern that might fit into, and the plotting techniques that we utilized that this young Lieutenant Commander Willis had originated using what later became called a desktop calculator. It was the early Hewlett desktop plotter that you could put information into through a keyboard. Anyhow, I went back to Washington. I was called on the person who had just returned, about 4 months previously, as being Comm 6 Fleet, and that was Admiral Ike Kidd, who had always been very kind to me. As a matter of fact, he was on my flag selection board, and he was one of the surface officers among several aviators. And of course, to be selected, I had to have the vote of those aviators, and that's what surprised us all. But I also called on Admiral Sumwalt, naturally, and briefed him. And at no time was there an intimation from Admiral Sumwalt that he had something in mind, but Admiral Kidd mentioned to me that he was going to look at, when my tour was up, getting me to come in as his expediter on the shipbuilding program, and particularly for new construction of new concepts.
Ike Kidd was Chief of Navy Materiel at the time.
Right, he was Chief of Navy Materiel, good point. And so that kind of shook me up. And
but he indicated he would wait until your current tour
right,
was complete.
Yeah,
right.
Very, very kindly gentleman in that respect. And I always had the highest regards for him, even at the time he was executive assistant to the CNO. And I think it may have been Atma Burke at the time.
Yeah.
It could have been McDonald, I forget. But there was natural competition between he and Admiral Zumwalt when it came time for Admiral Zumwalt's selection. And they had been running as real head and shoulders classmates. And I can say that Ike Kidd fully and absolutely was the perfect example of what a senior officer should be in supporting an official's directives when perhaps he personally may not have agreed with them, but he gave the boss the benefit of his views and then said, however, I will support you in any way possible. He was one example of that, who was a real competitor of the Admiral's that was under consideration for that particular job when they selected Admiral Zumwalt. But he was very, very much supportive of it, in contrast to the one who followed. But let me get back to the point better. The call then, I just come down from Washington, having done that briefing, and and then we had to make a trip up to Newport to brief the I was to speak at a commencement exercise for the OCS class, which I did. While I was doing the address, a call came in from the CNO, which they took, and they said, well, gee, he's on the podium right now speaking, and do you want us to call him off the podium? And he said, oh, no. He said, I've got to go down to the Joint Chiefs of Staff message, tell him I'll call him back at his quarters in Charleston tonight at, I think he said, 10:30. Well, that meant we were to be back in Charleston by then. And as I sat down after the speech, I was glad they gave me the note after the speech instead of before. Anyhow.
The note didn't tell you what he wanted.
No.
But you began wondering, obviously.
Oh, you sure did. Any time. But we walked in the quarters. The phone was ringing. I sat down by the bed and picked it up, and he was on the phone himself direct, and there was no one else placing the call for him. He was calling from his quarters also, and he said, I want you to come to Washington as soon as you can. Yes, sir, for a visit. He said, no, for permanent duty. And so I said, may I ask what you want me to do back in Washington, sir? I'll come as soon as you want me. And he said, I want you to take over the recruiting command. Well, that was really like a blow to the stomach because, as I've indicated before, that was not the place you would expect somebody to go because they had aspirations for a long career. Because of that decline of having to get out and sell the Navy. The fact that the Army was making huge draft calls was attracting people to the Navy and the Air Force.
The ground pounder.
So I said, you know, in my moment of trying to gather my thoughts, what did I do wrong, boss?
How did he respond?
Well, he laughed first and then said in his pseudo mad voice of, don't give me any of that bullshit. I want you to get off your ass and quit playing with those ships and come up here. I need you. Then he got very serious and he said, President Nixon is really on the Navy's back. We are not making our numbers. In December, even though the Army was making large draft calls, The Navy made only 50% of their numbers. Quality is significantly declining, and the recruits that we're taking, that we are taking in, I've been begging them for heroic action, and they have come forward with nothing. Begging them for heroic action that I could help them with to correct the problem and improve the recruiting command, and I've been getting nothing. He says, I want you up here to take it over as soon as you can.
This problem was still a serious one even after Admirals of Malta become known for reforming the personnel policies in the Navy?
Yeah, because of the public anti-military attitude predominantly. There was nothing really adverse publicly about the Navy. There had been no significant riot problems. It was a military thing in general. There was the knowledge, I think, passed on by those who had gotten out of the Navy about these 10-month deployments, about the terrible work problem, and then the horrors of Vietnam itself, and you might wind up going to Vietnam, the Muddy Water Navy, and things like that. So, and then the other part, the fact that they weren't flocking to us, and we had to get out and sell, and we didn't have a selling organization. We had a kind of a clerical organization, and we had a lot of people that shouldn't have been in a public confrontation
or a public relations
job. It had been an easy job, and so you sent people there that you didn't expect much out of. This is unfair to those few who were really trying hard and were good officers and petty officers, and I can't and won't try to name any names on it. But I came back, briefly, and I told him about a hernia operation that I had to have, and he says, you better get repaired as quick as you can, because I want you to hit it running up here. Aye, aye, sir. And that was about the limit of it. Had the operation, got relieved. They sent down a very interesting individual to relieve me, and if you've read much about the Radford incident, Bob that relieved me.
Wellington. No.
He was an officer that was the White House liaison for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He had a yeoman that it turned out had been filching papers out of the chairman's, out of Kissinger's briefcase.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Bob Wellington. I can just see him, but I can't see his name.
Very good officer, and he
good.
Was
okay.
Very handsome and
nice
and capable naval officer that had been placed in a tough job. He was trying to operate in the mode of his predecessor, who was very much an action-oriented type that I'd known for many years, but another story. He was sent down to relieve me. I had the operation and got back up there in April of 72. They sent down a team. The officer that I relieved, Rear Admiral W.M.A. Green, Bill Green, with an E on the end of Green, was a superb destroyer officer, was a perfect gentleman, and superb leader, but you could not call him aggressive, and he was not getting support up the chain of command for the things that needed doing. And despite the pleas that Admiral Zumwalt had made, Bill felt constrained to try and do everything by the chain of command rather than going direct to Admiral Zumwalt and saying, I'm unable to get my information through to you of what I think is necessary. And so I try never to criticize Bill Green. I think he was doing the best he could within the principles that he was operating, which you've got to say are commendable, until it comes to the point that you owe something to your higher superior And when you see it at a crisis stage, you should act. Now, when I went in, I was given direct orders by Admiral Sumwalt. He said, "You will be in direct violation of my orders if you fail to let me know of obstacles in your path that are you're unable to overcome, be it outside the Navy or inside the Navy, and specifically inside your chain of command." He said, "You will not be disloyal to them, and I will so inform them that you have that authority and requirement to report directly to me when there's something in the way, and then we'll all get together and see about the solution." And he did that, and so, you know, I couldn't have asked for any finer tasking. At the change of command, one of the things that I said, there are three reasons. I hope I can remember all three of them right now. But one, we've got a product. I see this as a job to sell. We've got to appoint the American youth and public for the job that needs to be done by the Navy, and that it the type of Navy that it is, meaning we've got a product now that we can sell. So we've got to inform the American public. We've got to let them know about the product, because it is a product that we can all be proud of. And thirdly, I have every confidence in you as the recruiters to be able to do this, because I've seen what you can do when challenged by overwhelming odds, such as in Vietnam, and in something that is new and unique. And it will be a new and unique adventure for all of us. And I pledge you my best support." And that was about it. The first thing that I did was to take about 2 weeks touring, which got cut short to 1 week because Admiral Sumwalt wanted me back for a report on what I needed to get this thing going.
Sounds like how I got you to Vietnam.
Yes, yes.
So I, on the plane back, was drafting the one page, 7 points of what I felt were most needed.
And there were eight recruiting areas at that time.
No, there were only five.
That's right,
we expanded
there were five.
It later.
That's right.
We divided it up into eight later. And so I gave him my one page when I got back, and things that I had indicated for action for him, he got on right away. Bill Green had told me there's a message that's been hung up in the administrative chain over in OPNAV at a given admiral's level, trying to get the CNO to express the priority that he wants assigned to recruiting, and for all of the commanders to know his priority. So that was the number one thing that I tracked down, found out it was held up, rewrote the message, stating clearly rather than diplomatically that recruiting is my number one priority. We must get sufficient numbers, get geared up for an all-volunteer force without the emphasis of the draft, and they must be quality personnel. The second thing I found out, the reasons why the detailers were not sending us quality officers at the mid-level management, was because it was a dead-end track. They had been trying to get the, for instance, the lieutenant commander billets that were recruiting divisions, like the Oklahoma City Division. Division, what do we call them? The areas, and then district, recruiting district.
That's it.
That was the second level below headquarters. It's an officer in charge billet, and they do not get credit for a command because it's designated as an officer in charge billet. And I said, "How much will it cost?" And it's a no-cost option. And it was hung up in the administrative side of the Pentagon. And I went over and made one visit to the admiral designated, and he's the administrator for the VCNO. So I called not on the VCNO, but on that administrator, Rear Admiral, and told him this had been hung up. This was a big thing that was preventing getting good lieutenant commanders to come and take these district jobs, which was in effect a very responsible command. And I had a two or three page spelling of their responsibilities, and I said I would like this designated as soon as possible as a command billet so that we can start bringing in command eligible lieutenant commanders for them. And Admiral Zumwalt has already said he thought he fully concurs with this. So I got a, you know, okay, and somewhere found it and signed off on it and got it done. There were two or three things like that that, you know, the bureaucracy had held up. And you...
Deliberately or just inertia?
Inertia. Inertia.
In the too hard basket.
I didn't run into, in my job, any of the deliberate obstruction. And I was fortunate in that. And he had gone through the rough phases of getting his program launched. It was now in the implementation phase, and I was exploiting that in our advertising and in our personal speeches. And it was a job that, in its new challenge, there was no equal to in the Navy, and nobody could say this is the way it should be done, this is the way we've done.
It had never been done.
So I, and fortunately, in my industrial management course, I'd taken a lot of marketing and statistical analysis and advertising back at the University of Oklahoma, so I was able to relate to this whole thing as a marketing challenge. We had a product to sell. We didn't have to create a market for it, but we had to inform the public of what the product was and why it was good and
now,
best.
Now, this was courses that he took between wars.
Right.
When he went back after World War II and got his degree, he was commissioned before he got his degree to take part in the invasion of Japan.
Right.
So,
went back and got the degree, and I had shifted from engineering to industrial management because I could get the most credits to count. I had decided already after some of the problems in engineering that I didn't want to be an engineer. And I wasn't too sure they wanted me to be. But it turned out to be one of those great things that turned out well because I could draw on that, make use of it in a number of ways. The cooperation periodically had to be encouraged by the CNO, and he would do it. He said, let me know when there's an area that you want me to make a speech in, especially, and then my aide has been instructed to keep you informed about travel schedule and of where we could work in a speech someplace, like if he was going to Oklahoma to talk to the Chamber of Commerce on Navy Day, then what could he do to help recruiting? He could always help recruiting by a short, brief visit with the recruiters and their wives. It was so important for the dependents because they were off away from any military support whatsoever. They were loners in the neighborhood. They didn't have the support group that they were accustomed to after many years in the Navy. And so it was important for them to know how essential the job that their husband was doing. Although this was shore duty, we don't see Daddy much because he's traveling frequently on the weekend. He works late at night. Those were the kind of people we got in who were self-motivated like that. We had to set up a training program, and this we did by greatly expanded what had previously been just an enlisted training program of what the rules and regulations are. We got it more marketing and selling oriented, expanded the school facilities. We're down in Pensacola, and that became both an officer and an enlisted training command, headed up by a four striper, trying to pick, and we did a lot of contract work, bringing in motivational speakers, and there's a whole industry of that, as you might know. We were fortunate in getting one of the, what I consider the finest of advertising firms, the finest because they never once violated the rules that I laid down about not taking advantage of officers, trying to sway them in any way with the Hollywood and Broadway and Wall Street business. And it was always a rule that never would that advertising firm pay for my lunch or a drink or anything like that. Aid had absolute orders so that there would, could never be a claim that my recommending them for renewal of the contract would be swayed by how they treated me. And that was to go all the way down the line, and only had one exception. Those kind of myriad challenges came up. I think one of the more interesting things of how the Admiral helped me on one of those times, I had to go around the corner. That advertising program had gotten underway, and Bill Green gets credit for having selected the firm that turned out to be so successful.
Great.
And the campaign itself, for the initial campaign, was approved by him. But two or three or four months had gone by, and there had actually not been the payment coming through from the Navy to the advertising firm. And the senior vice president of Gray Advertising that was handling our account came to me in the office one day and said, you know, I know the Navy has the complexities of the budget process and the bureaucracy, but we've got payroll to meet. And we've hired some of the best people on the street, as they call it. And we got to pay them if we want to keep them. And my board is getting a little bit antsy here as to when the Navy's going to start paying. And I said, what do we need to carry us forward to complete this current cycle? And he said, we need at least $1.2 million as soon as the Navy can come through with it so that I can retain these people. He had always told me when I asked, what is a given campaign going to cost? And he says, whatever you are willing to pay for, because the quality of creative talent on the street is competitive. If you want a, you know, a $10 paint job, you get a $10 paint job. If you want a $200 job, you pay for a $200 job and get it. And that's the way creative talent is. And it's very competitive for the best creative talent. So that was the problem he faced, to retain that team that he had formed. We were well impressed with. They had a lot of spirit and a degree of devotion to that Navy account that impressed me for a lot of civilians. I called and spoke directly with Admiral Sumwalt, and I said, I got a real cash flow problem that's not moving through the process, and I need to talk to you about it. He said, have breakfast with me tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock, and let me know what you need. I came over with one page point paper, spelling out what the problem was while he was eating his cereal. And he was looking at the paper, and he said, how much is it you need? And I said, $1.2 million. And he reached over on the point paper, and he says, in a much less legible than this,
yes, worst handwriting.
I owe you $1.2 million. And he tore it off, and he handed it to me, but much smaller than that. And he says, okay, next problem. I says, have a good day, sir. And later in the day, I had Jerry Martyr come in to see me.
Yeah, he'd be a Gray Advertising.
He's the Gray Advertising Senior Vice President, who called on me.
Great.
And he said, well, sir, any luck? And I said, don't believe in luck, but here's the payment, and it'll be coming through. And he says, that's good enough for me. And the wheels started grinding, and by the end of the week, he told me they had their money. And so what the Admiral did after that with his torn up piece of paper,
I don't know.
My end of the deal, and
that's probably in a file somewhere in Washington.
We have that piece of paper.
Yeah.
We made Jerry give it back to us.
But I don't know where the point paper went. At any rate, the results got there. But that was the kind of support they got. He would make appearances in the field where it was feasible. His staff cooperated with me. The aviators cooperated because they were getting desperate for inputs to their NAVCAD, not NAVCAD, but to the Aviation Officer Training Program. they had, during the war, used less than college graduates, as you may remember. These officers ran into a block when it came to career progression because they did not have a college degree, and so they could not go to advanced educational courses. And as a consequence, the Navy either lost their services or had to pay for sending them to college, which both courses of action happened. And so we wanted to stick with college graduates, and that was in line with the highest possible quality for the Navy. To do this, I had to have good aviators to make contact with the colleges. And to do that, we had to show evidence that this was not going to be detrimental to their progression in their career track, because recruiting wasn't on anybody's career track a good jobs to have for recruiting, until Admiral Zumwalt put out lots of letters and lots of correspondence, the fact that it was number one priority, and we were, in fact, as he did for Vietnam, we're selecting the very best available to do this job that now is the essential challenge for the Navy.
Captains were selected for Admiral through recruiting jobs. Through
after we got those kind of people in place.
Yeah.
And so we had to do some things to entice the aviators in. One thing that they did that both helped them and me, they had a trainer, and it was the T2C, as I recall, the T2 Charlie, a little twin seat trainer that they wanted to transition into an advanced model, and they saw it as a good opportunity to show a worthwhile use of the older trainer and yet do a good job that would help aviation recruiting, and in turn it would be my responsibility. So I wound up, because I had 52 recruiting districts, I eventually wound up with something slightly over 52 T2Cs, so that, and then how do you take care of them spread all over the United States? We did it by contract. You've got all sorts of commercial private planes that have got to have their routine maintenance. So there are some pretty good commercial facilities for getting routine maintenance. And so with a couple of officers assigned to supervise that program, we got the routine maintenance done using the Navy's procedures and inspections. We got some real hotshot good young lieutenants in because they saw this as a chance to, you know, I don't have to stand in line for a flying opportunity. You mean I'm going to have my own plane? And that's what they did. And they'd come into a campus like this and they'd say, you know, they find a good candidate and talking to it, one of the frat houses or parties or receptions or at the bar, and I can take you up, would you like to go? They'd start talking about, you know, they've always thought about something about aviation and so forth, and he says, I can take you up for a ride when you're ready. And so to take them up and do all the things with them, let them try flying it, you know, and it gives the recruiter a chance to evaluate them. Another thing we did, they didn't like driving up in the initially, all of the Navy recruiting cars were hand-me-downs from the naval districts. The old black, looked like a black Mirage or something that had been worn out by the naval district and then turned over to recruiting rather than junking it. And so with money, we bought, and we had to buy everything through the General Services Administration. I wanted all white cars with a good Navy that good Navy seal on the side, and then they go Navy, and
sailors have more fun.
Right, and GSA said that you cannot have white cars, so you will take whatever we give you. I said, you give me what you've got that's new and I'll paint it. They said, you can't do that. It's got to be white when it's turned back in.
A black when it's turned back in.
Oh, it's got to be the original color when it's turned back in. I said, I'll paint it any color you want when I turn it back in, but I'm gonna paint them white. And so we started the Great White Fleet in recruiting. And it really caught the eyes for long. Army recruiting was out with their light green sedans, and Air Force came out with a light Air Force blue and so forth, instead of everybody having black vehicles.
Too many people, when those black cars drove up, felt like it was the chaplain bringing a death message.
Yeah. But, so we got the white ones for the recruiters, and then there was one Union lieutenant said, you know, if I had one of those new Camaros to come up that had the big gold wings on it, I'd really get their attention at the frat house. So I talked it over and found that it would be legal, and we got Camaros for the recruiter, the aviation recruiters, and that really caused a stir. But you know, those kind of things, because you could see that it was a way to get the attention of the kind of quality people that you wanted. And we met our numbers, and we did it.
And then you also got the Cortez?
Oh, one of the things that Muggs and I were talking about as we drove up from Charleston on the way up to Washington on that frantic move, I had been briefed on one of their key problems was, I mentioned, I think, Bill Green sent a briefing team down to me just while I was recuperating from the operation. And one of the key things that they said is our difficulty of getting locations for our recruiting offices. GSA controls that, and they confine us to whatever is convenient to them, not as a quality recruiting market.
Stinkin'
the offices are in the basement of an old courthouse that closes up, you know, at 5 in the afternoon and on the weekend, and that's hardly a conducive time to get people in for testing or interviews or drop-ins, much less the quality market that you're interested in, where across the hall the prisoners are lined up waiting to be called in for the night's drum call. So we were talking about how can we get quality locations, and then we saw some of the Winnebagos going down the highway, and naturally we had always longed for a way to be able to take leisurely trips ourselves. And I started thinking, you know, why couldn't we get Winnebago specially outfitted for as a testing location? Call them in, show them films,